Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer or artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field, along with contest winners and a few surprise guests. Today, we are speaking with a brilliant artist and one of our more recent Illustrators of Future judges. Welcome, Craig Elliott.
Hi, John. Thank you so much.
Interestingly enough, this podcast is a finalist in the People's Choice Podcast Awards.
Yeah.
That's in our category. Cool. So that's good. So even if, I mean, I was surprised to get to this far in it. So they've got over 800 entries and in 20 different categories and over 500,000 people voted. So awesome. It's intense. Yeah. So to be in that category, that in itself is like way cool. I'm already just like over the moon with that. So the whole purpose of the contest is to provide that helping hand for aspiring, in this case, artists. Now, how familiar are you in anything with about Hubbard, his essays that he wrote on art, just the concept of the contest that he continues?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly am aware of that, and I'm aware of like his career and, you know, his contributions to sci-fi and, you know, maybe a little bit more about Frazetta's involvement with it and kind of how he was part of starting that.
So it was, it's in this, we got this book here that was put together several years ago, and it's got a really, really nice article by Frank Kelly Fries about Hubbard being one of the only writers in New York who would take time out to talk to the illustrators. He talked to them, and because he said back then, you know, the writers were very aloof and they were like in their own little clique and they didn't, you know, you're just an illustrator. And he was so not that perspective. And
well, it's clear that that's the case. Yeah. I mean, I sort of see him as the kind of a parallel, you know, to George Lucas, that he, for some reason, they both have this, additional and parallel interest in art that really has made a big difference in their work. And it's just interesting to see that there's not that many writer creator types that also are visual. Mm-hmm. And maybe vice versa, I don't know.
it's interesting you mentioned that. In the first Star Wars, there's that scene in the bar scene where Luke Skywalker meets Han Solo to secure the ship to get off the planet.
Right.
And it's almost word for word a scene that's in a story that Owen Hubbard wrote called The Kingslayer or Seven Steps to the Arbiter.
Okay.
And it was funny when I read it, that's Star Wars. And then I realized earlier on, George Lucas said, yeah, he was inspired by a lot of Pulp Fiction.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Well, yes, this is clear. Yeah. You look at this kind of it's not such serious science fiction. It's there's some fun in there, and mm-hmm. even Raiders of the Lost Ark is very pulpy, like, you know,
it kind Mandalorian of, right now, currently Mandalorian, it's that same,
yes,
it's a western, it's a science
right.
fiction western,
right? And but it's got a little humor, it doesn't take itself super seriously.
Exactly.
It's like it knows what it is. Yeah it's interesting, all these parallels between that. Well, it's like if you started off with that taste, then it's still part of what you do, mm-hmm. you know, however long
years later,
you do what you do, yeah.
Yeah. So that's one thing about how he created the Illustrator Contest as part of the Writer Contest, because of it's paying for it, but it's also the importance of that genre, you know, that it needs to continue. And as you see so much happening right now, in the 30s and 40s when he was writing, you had, you know, it was called escapist fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, you had, at least in America, you had the Depression, you just finished World War I, World War II was imminent, you know, because it was rumbling over in Europe already for several years before we entered. And half of America was out of work and they didn't know if they were gonna be working next week or not. So they valued this type of fiction as a means of being able to get along. So that's really important too, even currently. And so a lot of people say, I just love it because it just takes me to other places. And I just love the ride. And because Riders of the Future is PG, we don't get into the other stuff. It's appropriate for middle school on up. And what's really amazing too, is we saw it in this book here, this volume 36.
Right.
You know, the diversity. So there's all types of different art that wins. You know, it's not just, it has to be this style of art.
Right.
Now we're talking about art. So anybody can actually, if they're good, can win, because that's the purpose of what we're doing here. So that's why I'm so excited that you're on board now as a judge, because you add your own dimension to the contest, because it's not a matter of just like, okay, I want to do illustration, period. It's like illustration is a base for getting into all types of things. And we're going to talk about your specialty, you know, in a moment here. So how did you first become involved or find out about the Illustrators of the Future contest?
Wow. I think I've known about it for most, well, before my official illustration career. You know, I was like in the early 90s or mid 90s, maybe I became aware of it. Started buying the books. You know, as an artist, usually I buy the books for their covers, and then discovering the wonderful stories inside, and you know, and also branching out and discovering Hubbard's work as well. And I didn't, it was not something that I even ever thought of trying to enter, strangely enough, because I thought, oh, well, that's, you know, it's too good for me, sort of. But I see things differently now, being on the other side of it.
Yeah.
And I realized, wow, it really is for everyone. And, you know, there's such a wide range of entrants and styles. And, you know, and that's one of the cool things in seeing the art, is that there's stuff that I have never even thought of painting, or ways I've never even thought of painting. You know, it's almost, you know, it's a great art resource in and of itself, because, you know, you're pulling from so many different countries and so many different styles. I know I found out about it when I was at Art Center in like maybe 93 or 4 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I started collecting the books, and then many years later, you guys, you know, I'm involved with you. So it's really a nice circle in that sense.
Yeah. So you originally came and spoke. It was like, was it Echo or Lazarus that brought you in to speak? And then the following year said, this guy rocks, we want him as a judge. And that's when the invitation went for that. But so that was it through Lazarus or Echo or both?
Echo. Well, I've known both of them kind of in parallel, for, because they had a booth right by mine at Comic-Con for maybe 10 years of the 16 or 17 years that I was there. Mm-hmm. So I've known them for a long time. And, you know, of course, you know, when you see somebody on a regular basis every year, not just that, but also at other conventions, you know, Spectrum, I think we've met at that show, and I think they've come to Lightbox, and then just other, you know, stuff in New York for illustration, or they're always at everything. It feels like I'm always like chasing them. Yeah, so I've known them for a long, and Echo and I have a similar style and kind of artistic interest. So I think we have always kind of connected on that level, and that, like, yeah, we, you know, I get you, you get me. Like, that's kind of nice.
Yeah, that's good. So what's the significance for you of being a judge for the Illustrators of the Future? What does it do either for you, or do you feel like it does for the industry?
Wow. It feels like, I mean, it's such an honor, number one. And I think if I can get the word out there more, I mean, the people that know me because, largely because they know my work in animation. And that's a big area that I don't think that Illustrators of the Future has really reached out into yet. And I think that each of these industries, including animation, has a tendency to kind of silo itself. They feed off of themselves, and they don't reach out into other areas and cross over.
Right.
And I'm kind of one of those people that I'm like this, I'm a hub. I do everything. Like I have a shop in the back with a blacksmithing shop and, you know, metal machining and, you know, I do sculpture and jewelry and, you know, I cross over into lots of different areas. And so I really get the value of cross-pollination. And, you know, if animation people that know me find out about, you know, the contest and even just all of the work of Hubbard and all the wonderful work that you guys do, and also vice versa, that the people that are already hooked in with Writers and Illustrators of the Future, you know, see what we do in animation through me, because there's, you know, it's like a hallway. Mm-hmm. And there's a door into animation and there's a door in, and if I can, like, you know, be the person that goes, hey, there's a door right here. Look, you know, if you want to open it and look inside. And maybe before nobody saw that door, you know, the people that were involved with Illustrators and Writers of the Future, I'm sure, you know, lots did, but, you know, having me be there, I can just be like a chauffeur and, you know, hey, look, you know, come inside and see. And I think that can, you know, that cross-pollination can only help, whether it's, you know, an aspiring illustrator that wants to enter the contest or just somebody who, like me when I was in school, was just following the whole thing. And, you know, maybe they want to look me up and say, oh, look, this guy does this. And I didn't even know you could do this. That's, to me, that's a huge thing when you're starting out as an illustrator. You're so, like, especially, you know, when you're in training, whether it's in a actual school or nowadays you can learn online and, yeah, you know, kind of piecemeal, whatever it is, you really don't know. This, the common theme is that you don't know how the real world works. You know how, like, lighting on a sphere works, but that's different from what you can do with the talent you're developing when you get out there. And, like, I had no idea that you could work as an artist in the film industry. And I was like going to school in Pasadena, or, like, you know, the LA area. And that seems like ridiculous to me now, but I literally had, it was like this surprise to me that, wait, and I, you know, it's like, I should have known, like, there were artists that worked on Star Wars and Alien and, you know, all these movies and things. And I didn't even think about animation. It was all because of one guy that I knew, and he was the only one in my class that had any interest in art for film. And he and I became best friends, and he really, like, opened up the whole world of film design for me. And, you know, if I can do that for someone else, that's like a huge gift, because, I mean, that's become my career. Maybe it's, you know, somebody's career out there and they don't know it yet.
That's great. Cause that's, when we first started the contest, we only ever had our 12 winners, but now there are so many people entering the contest. Between the writer and illustrator, we have thousands of entries every quarter. And so it's huge. So now that we've got the finalists and semifinalists and honorable mentions categories, people are now using that in their resumes successfully to get sold, get bought, to get, you know, to advance their career. You know, I see more and more press releases coming out with books being written. Yeah, I was a finalist. I was a semifinalist in Writers of the Future. So because it's blind judging and it's free entry, so it's open to anybody can, there's no longer even, when we first started, you had to submit hard copy in the mail. And the, you know, this saying of a starving artist is not an unreal, you know, statement. So now we have artists from all over the world submitting, because they can upload it to, as long as they've got access to Wi-Fi, they can upload their three pieces of art and submit, and it goes to the judges, and the judges have no idea, you know, nationality. I mean, you can sort of tell nationality because of the type of art that it is, but it's not a disqualifying thing. It's just, they don't know who the person is that's submitting. And so we have all types of people. Last quarter, the end of the first quarter, which we announced, all three writer winners and all three illustrator winners were female. That's never happened before. But it's just like, whatever's the best of the best is what it is. But now, because there's so many great, you know, artists and writers submitting, just being able to be a finalist, a semi-finalist, honorable mention, is noteworthy and gets people work, because they know that there is no, you know, okay, I'll pay you $10 and I'll pay you an extra this much or whatever. It's not a vanity contest at all. It's strictly merit, you know, because you have no idea who you're looking at. There's a number assigned to the art that you see, and that's all that you get. And we don't know who it is until the number gets back and gets transcribed onto the Excel file that it's on there. And they're like, oh, okay, that's blah from wherever it is. So that's really good. So for what it does for paying forward to in the future of whatever type of art, you know, as it manifests itself, because what you're doing right now didn't exist at the start of Writers of the Future and Illustrators of the Future. It's brand new. So anyway, it's really great, because your addition to the competition is what you're saying is just what I was looking for when we said let's get him on board. So that's great. So for anybody that doesn't know you, let's describe a little about, like, you said a little bit what you do, but so like some of your more known critics that people will oh yeah, he did that, oh yeah, because I go to your webpage and go, wow, he did that. So what are some of the ones that you're the most proud of?
Wow. Yeah, like you said, there is a long list. I think it's, you know, in terms of like TV and film, I'm over 35 projects now. I started in 95 or 96 on Disney's Hercules. That was my first job. I was, before college, I was a paper boy with the San Jose Mercury News. And then I got a job at Disney. So it was like this big change. Like, not saying that the being a paperboy can make you, you know. It was a very odd, like, switch, because I spent all my time basically learning to be an artist and not doing summer jobs to buy a car. And I didn't have a car, you know.
Yeah.
Didn't want a car. So, yeah, I started at Disney as a layout artist, which doesn't really exist anymore in the sense that it used to. Basically, that job in all the 2D animated films was to be like a cameraman that drew everything the camera saw. So, you know, if there's a shot of me in this room and all this art stuff behind me with a microphone here, we would do a drawing of everything in the room. And even if the camera moved, all of the stuff that the camera covered then, and then, you know, things would also be broken into layers. So the microphone would be here, and I could, you know, the animator could animate me going behind the microphone, but in front of this background.
Right.
So we would have to figure out where, you know, and each character would be in a different location in the stack. So, and then also we would time all of the different levels to move at different speeds to give the sense that when there's a camera move, that there was actually depth and parallax. Mm-hmm. So there were some very technical aspects to it, as well as the artistic aspect of having to draw everything the camera sees. And we even drew the characters in place, not animating them, but just like, you know, character A starts here, then moves over here, and then goes off the screen at this point. Like A, B, C, we labeled them with letters. So I did that job for like Hercules, Mulan, Emperor's New Groove, Treasure Planet, Chicken Little, and Enchanted. But then I also, around Treasure, like at the same time, I also did do design for the film. So like in Hercules, the underworld, the kind of the dark place where Hades lives, I designed a lot of the stuff in that. And so there's like little pieces of each film that I actually did design on my own, because I always had this interest in doing that. And there was always a period in layout where we didn't have actual scenes to do, kind of before things really got going in production. And I would do like 40, 50 drawings a week, like, because I was so excited by that. And then I started to get more and more into that. By the time I got to Treasure Planet, I did so much designing on that. You know, maybe a third of the film is stuff that I've designed. Mm-hmm. You know, especially the beginning and the end, the planet where Jim starts at, and then the alien planet. I did a lot of that. And then, you know, so that job is essentially kind of what I do now. And I've just sort of risen to the ranks of now that I'm the production designer on a film at Netflix now. And I'm so that's sort of the head of the art department. There's an art director and artist that work for me. And we all sort of do the same thing really. Mm-hmm. But I kind of coordinate the look and style based on what the director wants or the executive producers want. And in transitioning into that job, I got to learn how to work in color. I had a brain tumor when I was in school, and it was like messing up my vision and distorted my sense of color, strangely enough. It's like it was pushing on my eye nerves. So it was like stepping on a hose. I always make the analogy. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't seeing enough red. So I'd put more red in my paintings, but then I could tell it wasn't right. And so in school, I had a terrible time with color. But it got taken out when I was on Hercules, and all that stuff came back. But then I had to kind of like start over and learn how to paint color. So that's been a fun kind of journey in my career to add that to what I do. Some of the other projects that, I think Treasure Planet is my favorite that I've worked on, just because I love fantasy and sci-fi the most. And there's not that many animated films in the U.S. that are really kind of based around that or that's their, yeah, their theme. Mostly I end up doing kind of humans and animals, those kinds of things that, you know, what subjects come out with from U.S. Animation companies. But I also really enjoyed like working for Dungeons and Dragons. I worked on the 5th edition Player's Handbook. I did some illustrations in that. Mm-hmm. And also for Blizzard, they had a trading card trading card game back in the early 2000s, I think it was. Yeah. And it was a physical printed thing as well. And that was always kind of a really nice way to express my fantasy, you know, interest. I really love some of the illustrations I did for that as well. Now it's a digital thing. It's called Hearthstone. And it's a little bit more stylized. It's less sort of open than it was. I think those are some of the things that I really worked on that I loved.
That's amazing. And what's good, too, is because of what you're able to bring to it. And people just listening to this podcast right now, the aspiring artists, are like, you know, some people have this, I guess, this concept like you're born and you've got a paintbrush coming out of your mouth, you know, and like he was just born with it. It was just a natural, you know, but like I said, you transitioned from a paper boy. You know, obviously you've been working on art for a long time to get to where that you could go from paper boy to work for Disney.
Well, I took my first art class when I was a junior in high school, but I was, there was art in my family. Like a great aunt of mine did a Sunset magazine cover in May of like 1935, I think it was, and it's one of my favorite paintings. I never got to meet her, but. Yeah. Her and then also another aunt, Juanita, who lived in Santa Rosa. I did get to know her, and I think she was very much like me. She made jewelry and did oil paint. She was a California Impressionist. We had an exhibition like after she died of all these amazing Impressionist paintings she did. She was an illustrator. She turned her house, basically it was a chicken coop when she bought it, and she turned it into a place to live. And I love building things. I've add onto my barn, and I've built other barns and structures on my property.
Hold. Barn? Most people think of house when you say living, so explain barn, please.
I have, like, in the north area of Los Angeles, there's a town called Santa Clarita. that's growing really rapidly right now, but used to be very rural. And I bought a piece of property up here maybe 17 years ago. Uh-huh. That was essentially, I think, what it is, and I'm in the house part right now. I think the idea was that it was a mini ranch for someone who lived in LA that could kind of have this, like, let's go to the ranch on the weekend thing. And when I do the remodeling here, the inside the closet behind me that's a built-in, there's this like hilarious log cabin, like 1950s wallpaper. And it's like cartoon scenes of like little kids in plaid shirts with axes and people riding horses. And it was clear, like, there was marketing all throughout this house. It was very funny. So I think this whole neighborhood was just meant to be kind of like a horse playland or something. So I have 3 acres of land behind me and then a river at the end of it. And then the horse barn kind of in the middle, that is, I don't have horses. So for me, it's like a big tool shop. I have a blacksmithing or forge there, and I've got milling machines and you know, table saws and band saws and lathes and things like that. So I build frames for, you know, for my paintings. I do dimensional sculpture for film projects.
Did you build Death Stars for Star Wars?
That'd be nice. I think I was like 4 though, so that wouldn't have been possible. But yeah, like, you know, the last film I worked on, I 3D printed 3 of the characters and cleaned them all up, painted them, and then built like accessories. Like, you know, they have little accessories. I can't really say what they are yet because the film's not out, but, and bases, and then built electronics into them so that parts of them that glow in the film would glow when you saw the maquette. And it was part of selling the film to distributors. So they got to see something physical in this, you know, this glass case along with some of the concept art, and it helped the film stand out. And then for, I'm also doing a sculpture as a crew gift for a film that I just finished a few weeks ago. And I have casting facilities out in the barn, you know, pressure pots and vacuum chambers and things like that, that help you make really good, castings. So that's another, you know, that's a sort of a practical application. You know, I make some of the other stuff, you know, the blacksmithing stuff. I got into that because I want to make, I have designs for lanterns and door handles and things like that I want to do around the house, but also I make, you know, I'll collect railroad spikes along the railroad up here, along the tracks. And, you know, I made knives for my family, for my cousins, or a tomahawk, or, you know, they make, it's like great for gifts.
Yeah.
As well. So
that's crazy. That's great. So that's, thank you for the clarification of barn.
It's a big space that you can do whatever you want with. I mean, I guess I could move all the tools out and put some horses in there whenever I wanted to, but
it's probably money for you in the tools.
Yeah, just, you know, enough maintenance already. Like, I don't, and I've got a cat and a fish tank. That's enough animals for me. And most of my neighbors have horses. If I really want to ride a horse, I could just, you know, go over there and say, hey, like, you know, because most of the time they just sit there. They don't really.
Yeah.
They don't really use or do much with them unless they're training them. So,
okay. Now for a person that's starting off in art, you know, there's the idea of like, I want to specialize. I do illustration. I do oil. I want to do this. Like, in terms of diversification, being able to just do several things versus specializing one thing and then expanding from there. Do you have any particular thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a big area of semi-controversy. What I see happen, you know, and I go to a lot of conventions and do portfolio reviews for people, and mm-hmm. And I've done a lot of teaching, so I, you know, I hear this from my students too, and I think there is a lot of maybe misconception going around that you need to really focus on something and be very narrow in your portfolio, in your presentation of who you are and so forth. And I think a lot of that comes from HR and, like, you know, in terms of like animation companies or business people at publishers or, you know, art directors, less so from art directors. I think it's a misconception because it's sort of an oversimplification. Yes, you know, if there's something that you really, you know, if you want to work for Blizzard and work on their Diablo game, you probably shouldn't be doing big oil paintings of flowers. It does show skill. And an art director can interpret skill and be able to tell if somebody can do what they want them to do. But, you know, I understand the desire to think, well, I should never paint that. I guess what I want to really say is that you can and probably should be diverse in the end, but then also have something in the vein of what the person that wants to hire you is doing. So like, for example, my portfolio, I had some fantasy artwork in there that wasn't exactly like what Blizzard did, but they could see that, oh, okay, well, the stuff that he did for D&D is easily translatable to Blizzard. So I think it's being able to show that there's some translation there. And then the thing that I run into a lot of times when people say, you know, at least when thinking about animation, is they'll say, well, you have to decide whether you're going to work for a 2D animated TV show or a feature, or, and then you have to pick a style. And I see a lot of people that have that, they're too narrow in their focus, and it doesn't allow them, you know, because a lot of people that are hiring artists aren't art directors or other artists, you know, there's an HR department that's looking at all these portfolios. They do need to see something that's sort of similar to what they're doing. So that's why I say to the students that I have, I look at what they've done. Maybe they've done a lot of snow scenes and a lot of fantasy because they live in kind of a northern climate and that's sort of what they're used to. And I tell them, well, do something that's like, you know, tropical and sci-fi, like that you haven't done. And I think people think that, oh, well, that's not who I am because they haven't done that yet. And I'm here to tell you, no matter what you do, you can't help but do it the way that you're going to do it. It'll come out in your style. And that'll help because you don't know all the projects that are out there and the needs that companies have for illustration. And there's going to be a tropical sci-fi, you know, Avatar is going to call you next week if they see your illustration. You know, maybe not exactly that, but, you know, that's an example of sort of tropical sci-fi. But if that wasn't in your portfolio, they'd be like, especially somebody who's a business major, works in HR, like, well, this, you know, this person, we just can't, they're nowhere near what we want because they see snow scenes. And which is, as an artist, I think is kind of, you know, it's sad because I would be able to see the skill in the art and know that somebody could do Avatar, say, but that's not always the case. You don't always have artists looking at your work. You have, you know, in the sense of, in the book publishing world, you have writers and they're going to need to see something that's fairly close to what they're a kind of a close equivalent to a business major in a lot of cases, not all cases, of course, into a business major that works in HR at Warner Brothers or something like that. They're going to have some knowledge of art, but not the kind of knowledge that someone like I have. And you might get passed over because, you know, maybe it would just, you know, all you'd have to do would be like do a painting of a tiki bar and that'd be enough. Oh, they can do tropical, like, you know. And so that's why I always say be diverse. Don't be so diverse that people don't know what you're doing. Don't try to do you know, The Simpsons and then try to do Frazetta. And, you know, that's a little bit too wide. But I can say that I've done, you know, things in that diverse of a range in my career as well. So it's not, you know, it's not impossible, but that would make kind of a too wide of a portfolio, I think. I hope that sort of answers that question. I feel like I was kind of all over the place, but.
It does help. Yeah, it does help. Now, the other question on this is, as an art director, you know, and before that, as an artist, the concept of I've got to be myself, I've got to be true to myself, I got to have my artistic integrity says, right. I don't do what the art director is saying. Any tips or advice on that?
Yeah, well, that doesn't really usually work. unless you're hired, you know, that's the thing is, like, there are times for, you know, artistic integrity, and there are times for doing what the art director or the director asks for. For example, you know, taking Treasure Planet as an example, or even just working for those directors, Ron and John, Ron Clements and John Musker, who directed many Disney films. I think I got to know them the best as directors. And on Treasure Planet, there were sequences where they had a specific idea of what they wanted visually, or also the story defined certain parameters of what this thing had to be. It's like, so the Benbow Inn is this place where Jim's mother lives, and I guess Jim lives there too. And it's like a pub, a space pub. And there were some designers that designed, you know, a building on the top of a tall spire, and, you know, some that designed it flat on the ground, and, you know, in all different kind of permutations. And not all of them necessarily, like the one on a spire had this idea of, you know, there was like a pulley that would go up to the top, and you take an elevator and things like that. And the thing is, there were things in the story that had to happen. They had to ride up in a carriage, and you can't really do that. And you can't take 3 minutes of time for them to get into an elevator and la la la, you know, go all the way up to the top. And so you do have to think of the parameters that exist and work within those, mm-hmm. you know, and maybe they had also said that they wanted something that was kind of English half timbered and 30% sci-fi. There were these other kind of overarching, you know, ideas. And so an example like that had, you know, there was like two sides of a box. You know, I couldn't go off in these two directions, but then the other two directions were completely open. So knowing where your borders are and where your fences are is really important. And, you know, if you can't follow that, they can't really use your artwork. They, you know, and they'll likely not hire you again because they'll think, well, XYZ person doesn't really listen to what we want. But so that's one situation. And then on the other hand, there, you know, when we got to the planet surface and the act three of Treasure Planet, they had no, Ranjan had no direction at all. You know, they would say, we want it to look alien. Like, and that's huge. Like there's no sides to the box really. So within one project, and we're working for one pair of directors, there was a variety of experiences. I mean, I think there were also areas where they were super specific and like, this room has to have, you know, three bottles of bubbling green liquid in it, and there has to be wainscoting, and the floor is red, and, you know, like most of the walls were already built kind of like in their mind, and going outside the box would just be silly, and, you know, you'd just be throwing artwork over your shoulder because they can't use it. So there are times to be, you know, have your artistic integrity and not. And I think you have to think of it that way. It's like, yeah, run with it when you're given the free rein to do it, but work within the parameters if you're given parameters.
Okay. That makes sense. Good. So any particular tips that you've got other than what we've already talked about for the aspiring artist?
Wow. again, that's a broad subject as well. You know, I think kind of like with my students and the people that I meet and do portfolio interviews for, I would say to, you know, most importantly is to be yourself and to do the work that you love, do the thing that inspires you. Like, you know, Joseph Campbell, follow your bliss, you know, like it, if it makes you happy, if the thing that you're working on and you're focusing on and thinking about and painting makes you happy, mm-hmm. that's going to lead you to your best work. You know, trying to do something else that somebody else has told you to do or follow a career path or a genre of illustration that you think you should do, whether it's your teacher or your parents or something, some idea that you're getting from the industry, those things aren't going to pan out for you. They're not going to, you know, like I say, you're not going to do your best work doing them. And yeah, sometimes I guess you have to, you know, we all have to make money somehow. And there are times where, you know, you work on a project that's not your absolute favorite, but you still do the best job that you can. And, you know, and maybe on the side, you're doing an oil painting of your own that fulfills that yearning or, you know, the artistic integrity that you need to get out. And that's something that I can say is true, is that as an artist, there's there's always this, it feels like we're this membrane that ideas are pushing against and always trying to get out. And I have way too many ideas, you know, way more ideas than I can ever execute in, you know, in any way. And, you know, you do need to always be listening to those ideas and doing something about them, even if it isn't, even if it doesn't apply to the job that you're doing now. And that, I mean, that's also why I say if it doesn't necessarily apply to the job you're doing right now, that's okay sometimes. And, but, you know, but always keep in mind, do the absolute best that you can in that job with the skills that you've got as well. Because you don't want to, you know, it's a skill that you have to develop. I do remember consciously developing this skill when I first started at Disney. You know, I think out of school where we don't really know how the world really works when you actually get a job. And I think especially when it comes to, like we had just talked about, the, you know, the artistic integrity thing, when you're in school, you really, really much can kind of do whatever you want. There's nobody that, you're not going to get kicked out of school for, you know, painting dragons, even though your teacher doesn't like dragons. They might lower your grade, but, you know, grades doesn't really matter in art. It's like, what does the art look like? So, but when you get a job and they're like, well, there are no dragons in this movie or in this book, and how come you gave me a dragon? You know, there's something that happens there that's not quite a match. And I do remember, you know, I think when I got to Disney, I felt like, well, I don't like the characters. I'm going to redesign the characters. And, you know, that wasn't my job at all. But I just had this, like, you know, all of that energy went into everything that I did. And I slowly learned to realize, okay, my vision doesn't always apply to absolutely everything. And sometimes I need to back off of it. And if I want to express my vision somewhere, I can do that somewhere else. I can do it at home on my own time, or, you know, maybe I've got an illustration job that I would do on the weekends that really is like what I really want to do. And so learning that kind of self-discipline of when to really crank up your own sort of imagination and integrity, artistic integrity, like you say, and then when to really help funnel and sort of help blossom the vision of the writer or the director of the project that you're working on. It's good to know when to do those things and when not to. And that really is a skill that you have to develop.
Good. Good. Well, thank you. For somebody to find you, how do they find you on social or web?
I'm fairly easy to find at this point. Just typing Craig Elliott or Craig Elliott Art. I'm usually kind of at the top of those. That's actually me. But I have a website, CraigElliottGallery.com. I'm Craig Elliott Gallery on Instagram. And then I think also on Facebook. But again, yeah, I'm fairly easy to find. ArtStation, I do have a pretty big presence on ArtStation as well. And I think I'm just Craig Elliott on that, or Craig _ Elliott.
Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Craig. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast and the Illustrators of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast is available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Player FM, iHeart, and Spotify. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by L. Ron Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to new and amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thank you very much, Craig.
You're welcome.